All right. This is In the Meantime with DJ Sweetie on enemycombatantradio.net. We are streaming on the internet live right now. It's Tuesday, the first and third Tuesdays of every month. And we might also be being picked up by Pirate Cat in San Francisco and Berkeley Pirate Radio over in Berkeley, California, and other places on the net. You can also download these shows at enemycombatantradio.net and /meantime. So I am DJ Sweetie in the studio here today with Lupe and Maria from St. Peter's Housing Committee. And why don't we just say hello and introduce yourselves?
My name is Lupe. I work with St. Peter's Housing Committee in the Mission in San Francisco.
My name is Maria, and I work with Lupe.
Okay.
Very lucky.
Very lucky people. So how long have you been working at St. Peter's?
I've been working at St. Peter's since July of 2001. So it's been almost, going to be almost 4 years.
4 years. Yes. How about you, Maria?
I've been there since 1999. So about 6 years in October.
Can you bring your microphones up a little bit closer?
Yeah.
Also adjust them like that. Thanks.
Sure. There you go.
Excellent. Okay, so tell us what St. Peter's Housing Committee is. Is that still the name? Is mm-hmm. it Housing Collective now?
It's still Housing Committee. We have
in a community, we like to call everything a committee.
Yes.
If anybody gets the time to look into archival footage or writings about any of the radical movements in Latin America, everything is a committee. There's committees within the committee, committees above the committee. It's very committee-focused. So we're going to stick to committee. We're also sticking to St. Peter's, which is the name of the church that founded the committee. But we're no longer affiliated except for the name. And
You're not affiliated anymore?
No.
With the church, no.
How
we
long
like
has that
them.
Been?
They like us. Yeah. But we branched out maybe like 96? Yeah.
I think so.
Neither of us were there for that. But
okay.
That's all before
we became
time.
An independent nonprofit mm-hmm. after being in the basement of the church for... years.
And what does St. Peter's do?
We're a tenant rights organization, and we work with Latino tenants in the Mission and in San Francisco on issues of eviction, repairs, harassment, displacement in the Mission. But we also have a membership component where we trying to create tenant power in San Francisco through leadership development, political education, with Latino immigrants in San Francisco.
Mm-hmm. And when we got started in the basement of the St. Peter's Church, it was a committee of parishioners at that church, mostly Latino seniors who were fighting to create rent control. And then they had done that campaign. And once they won that campaign, they wanted to tell people about what they had won. And so they created the St. Peter's Housing Committee to inform people about their rights. And that's still a big part of the work we do in addition to organizing to preserve and expand the rights of tenants and of working class people.
What year was that they actually won rent control?
I don't know.
I want to say like 84, 85. That's when St. Peter's was founded. It was 1985. So we got rent control in 1984, I believe, somewhere in one of those 2 years.
And St. Peter's, was that basically the lead of that struggle as the church or before the committee, or how was that? How did that work?
There was a wide community coalition. Mm-hmm. The St. Peter's Church and the St. Mary's Church both had committees of people that were in the leadership of that. The St. Mary's Church committee eventually became the Housing Rights Committee, which is our partner organization still to this day.
Wow. All right. Nice. So, and then you came on. What attracted you to working with St. Peter's Housing Committee?
Basically, what happened is this is after I graduated college. I was kind of finding somewhere where I wanted to work in terms of being a community organizer. And actually, Maria was already working at St. Peter's Housing Committee, and I knew her from other organizing efforts I've been a part of. And she's like, "You really should come work here," because actually, one of the big things that I wanted to get involved in was environmental justice issues, with the community in San Francisco. And also, I have a really deep personal commitment in terms of personally to just land struggles. And when she talked about the organization, I thought that was a really good place in order to, to truly fight for tenant rights. For me, is like an issue of like an urban land struggle within the people who are living here, who have a right to work here. And also the aspect of working, trying to incorporate environmental hazards, environmental justice issues into the organization really attracted me to it. So we're still working on that, but mm-hmm. I definitely, the issue of working, especially with the Latino community, also really attracted me to the to the organization, that it actually built Tenant Power. Mm-hmm. It wasn't just a service organization. It's what really attracted me to it.
Mm-hmm. Well, when I started working there, I needed a job, and I met someone who said, oh, there's this job available. You're bilingual. You should go to this organization. They want a bilingual Latina, and you could do it, and it's tenant rights information. And at that time, we did no organizing. But they were sort of interested in exploring it, sort of, but sort of not, because being a legal services organization actually takes a lot of resources. And there's a certain political perspective that comes when you invest in the legal system as a way to solve your problems. Mm-hmm. And so they recruited me and were sort of surprised. I was surprised, too, actually, with how it turned out, because there was so much potential for organizing. People would just come to us saying, once they arrived, they already had the consciousness, I have a problem. I need some help. I need to look at this collectively. And I think the landlord has some responsibility here. And that's just a wonderful opportunity for organizing, which, you know, it was a logical step right after that to actually try and organize tenants and form tenant unions by building to negotiate collectively with the landlord, sort of like a labor union does, and try to win their demands. And that's what we started doing. And after we had been doing that for a little while, recruiting Lupe was a big part of actually expanding our capacity to do that and taking that on, not just as an experiment, but actually as 50% of our work, organizing and legal services as the two components of our work. And then this last period in our transition, we've identified that movement building and alliance building is a third component of our work that we want to strengthen, because we see that the fight of Latino tenants in the mission can be part of a broader movement building strategy only if we make that a priority for ourselves, because otherwise, you know, we get trapped into building only our organization and only our fight, not being able to see the connections. Mm-hmm.
So how would you say that St. Peter's fits into that kind of community movement? Like, what has been their role over time? Has it changed a lot then? I mean, as you've gone from legal services, basically?
I think, at least my own perception of it, is that first, when St. Peter's was first formed, it was a membership organization of people from the community that actually created the organization. And it came out of a struggle in order to create rent control from the tenants. So I feel they went from that to more of like a legal services organization. And then I think in the last few years, we're trying to create, like, once again, have it be a membership-based organization. That's, you know, that we have a strong, that we have a real connection with our base in terms of having a strong membership, and at the same time trying to create links, not just within our community, but with other communities that are also going through the same issues, like in Chinatown, you know, or like Baby Hunter's Point, or like if we're talking like on a more statewide and a national, international level, also like creating connections to those other struggles as well. So I feel like there's been like definite changes since the organization has started, but I think right now we're trying to kind of make it once more and more of a membership organization.
Mm-hmm. How about, are there other groups then in the Mission District or in San Francisco that are like just like your organization? Are you one of many or very unique?
There's a lot of organizations that have things in common with us in terms of providing direct service, like advocacy on a day-to-day level, like you need a repair done and we can help you write the letter in English because you don't speak English. And at the same time, we'll have a meeting about INS raids and how they affect our community and who we should hold accountable for them and how that relates to the war and stuff like that. As far as I know, there's not that particular combination of things, but there's certainly people who do either of those things with a similar perspective, mm-hmm. and that we try to collaborate with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. One of them that I could think of would be, like, I know with, you know, Chinese Progressive Association, CPA, and the Chinatown is...
What is it?
Chinese Progressive Association. Uh-huh. At least for myself, that's one of the ones that I think that we have in common with them in terms of they also deal... This would do, like, housing issues, but more to organize tenants around housing issues. And so I feel like we have a connection with them in that sense. And both of our bases are, you know, working class, you know, immigrant bases, you know, so also like, how do we, and also the fact that there's a lot of like language issues also, which I think is really good to organize with like folks that are community also, like, that basically organize other immigrant populations to create those kind of alliances. Mm-hmm. And we work with them more on issues of like, you know, May 1st and, you know, more like organize, like, more organizing events, organizing, like, kind of more, like, collaboration stuff, but we're not working, and memberships aren't working together as of right now, but it's definitely one of those things that would be really great.
Mm-hmm. What is the state, then, of kind of rental housing in San Francisco today? I mean, rent control is secured, or is it under attack, and what are the prospects for more kind of working class housing in San Francisco at this stage? And the rental market is still high, yeah, and the housing in terms of selling real estate is crazy.
Yeah, I mean, San Francisco is so key as a particular geographical place in the international economy that real estate and the struggle over land is always going to be essential. And that's our assessment at St. Peter's, that it's always going to be essential to the local communities and to the possibilities of broader movement building, because the corporations of the world want to be here. And they need workers to run their corporation, to clean their floors and wash their dishes and change their kids' diapers and give them massages and stuff like that. And that's our people. And so they need us. It's part of the infrastructure that this city has that it requires in order to be, you know, California is like, what, the number five economy in the world or something? I mean, it's ridiculous, yeah. Right? And it also means that, you know, the struggles over land are always going to be really crucial. Every November, there's a proposal. Every November since I've worked at St. Peter's, about 6 years, there's a proposal that will basically, that the landlords put forward to gut rent control, or to create condominiums, which is also a way to decrease the stock of rent controlled housing, and it definitely is an immense pressure on working class communities, especially communities of color in San Francisco, because then we have clients who maybe have been evicted or got harassed and basically begin to commute like 3 hours to come work in a hotel in San Francisco, to come make beds in a hotel in San Francisco. And that, you know, it's just, it's the situation of so many people. And right now, it's not like when it was the dot-com boom, right, where, you know, hundreds of people would walk into our office and we knew they were getting evicted. Everybody that was coming in was getting evicted. That's not the situation that we're in anymore. It's not the same level of crisis, but there's still a crisis because there's still a lack of housing for people. And certainly when the dot-com boom did happen, it was a great opportunity for us as community advocates to understand the need to see the struggle long term, and to understand that there's going to be crisis and there's going to be moments where the fight is really high and everybody in the community. I remember a moment where anybody in the community, you could ask them, well, what's the biggest problem? And they'd say housing. Mm-hmm. And there was two sides you could be on. You could be on the side of the landlords or the side of the tenants. And that's the level of the struggle that we need to be ready to fight, not just to get attacked by. And that's one of the things that we learned during the dot-com boom. And that, so now maybe people are coming in with deposit cases, or a big issue that's affecting our community is raids from the INS. In our communities, and in the relationship between the police and the INS, and how that affects immigrant communities and your right to work or to live, and, you know, so that the issues change over time, but the struggle over land remains. You know?
And I think also one of the big issues right now is the fact that whereas, as Maria was saying, like, the in terms of not everybody is getting evicted as they were, you know, in terms of with the dot-com boom, like, now the one of the issues that I see is the landlords just refuse to do maintenance or refuse to do repairs, and people, there's definitely a lack of affordable housing, but there's even also a big, huge, huge lack of affordable, habitable housing. Like, you know, in terms of living in a garage that doesn't have any heat, that has mold, you know, that has chip paint, you know, in an old house, like, that is not a healthy place to live, but you don't have a choice because there is no affordable, healthy housing in this city. Mm-hmm. You know, and also the fact is that the landlords, you know, they can, if you, doesn't matter how much rent you pay, you shouldn't even pay your rent in the first place, but no matter how much rent you pay, like, they feel that should, that has to do with how much repairs you should get, you know? So it's like, that's one of the big problems right now is just people also not being able to find housing in San Francisco, but the housing that there is available that is somewhat even close to affordable, just isn't habitable, isn't being maintained the same way that someone who's paying $2,000 for a one bedroom is being maintained. Mm-hmm. Like, there's a big difference between what the working class, how the working class people are being, you know, in terms of the right to live here, in terms of the right to live in a healthy place, as opposed to, you know, someone who's, you know, someone who's white and who earns two, you know, who can pay $2,000 for an apartment, you know?
Mm-hmm. How many members do you have in your group? In terms of both staff and then in terms of like your general, what, dues-paying population? Or how does that work?
No. People invest their time or their contribution to a potluck or to a meeting. Some people contribute money, but most people don't. And we have about 200 members. Mm-hmm. And our staff is six. Mm-hmm. And we have also some volunteers from our membership and from the community that are like, you know, almost half time that actually work on different projects, helping us do the organizing work that we do. Mm-hmm. And they're sort of like in between sort of staff and membership levels. We also have two people on staff who were members, and that's how they came into the work. And that's one of the things that we're proudest of.
Yeah, that's great. What do you think that there's more? Did a lot of the people who were unable to find housing before, did they just simply leave, or they're on the street, or like how has that problem not at the crisis point that it was before? Is it just people aren't showing up to ask for help anymore, or are they just gone?
There's definitely a lot of people who are still showing up, who still have a lot of tenant problems in the city. That definitely has not gone away. Mm. I think a lot of people did have to move. You know, a lot of people had to move to either Fremont or, you know, Talking Merced, like Richmond, just places that were out of the community that they had been in for many, many years, where their families had set up roots. You know, their kids had gone to school since they were little. They basically had to set up and be, you know, had to set up and set up home somewhere else, basically. And now a lot of those communities are now being, you know, gentrified as well. Mm. You know, like we're talking Richmond, we're talking like Oakland, you know, Fremont.
Vallejo.
You know, yeah, like Vallejo, like all these other areas where a lot of families went to go live at because they were displaced from here are not being displaced once again. You know, it's kind of just mm-hmm. like a circle that's kind of going out, you know, by just, you know, people wanting to buy a property there. But I think people did have to leave in terms of, we have a lot of families that have been displaced from the, you know, housing in San Francisco that now have to live in SROs, mm-hmm. that now have to live in residential house, because that's the only, you know, now you could pay $700 for an SRO room.
Residential hotel.
Which is a residential hotel, which is like an 8x10 room with no kitchen, mm-hmm. no bathroom, that you have like one communal bathroom for the whole floor. You know, and you're paying $700 for that. And family of four, you know, can live there because that's all they can afford. And that's all the only place that will rent many times. You know, there's a lot of like, you know, also because immigration status, you know, because of children, like all these different forms people are being discriminated, you know, by in terms of landlords in the city. People have to go to families have to live in an SRO. That's one of the big changes that we noticed with the housing crisis.
And then at the same time, there's huge lofts that were built during the dot-com boom to cater to these middle-class professionals that were coming, that were working at these dot-coms, and then that sort of speculative bubble burst, and a bunch of companies went under, and they have those huge lofts, and it works for them to keep them empty longer and wait until there's an upsurge in the economy and someone can pay $3,000 again, rather than rent it to this family that has to live in this SRO unit, which is basically the size that most people buy for storage. Mm-hmm. This is the condition that our communities live in. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, there's not even sunlight. You know, plants can't even live without sunlight, but the children in our community are expected to live without sunlight. And there's nowhere to play. And there's all the power and control issues that landlords use to abuse tenants because they know about people's immigration status, or they know that someone is hiding from their abusive husband, and that's why they're at the hotel. Or they know that someone's working under the table. Mm-hmm. It's just, it's a really, it's a situation where the landlords really abuse the power that they have because of the pressure created by the economy, mm-hmm. which people in our communities feel the brunt of.
Would you say that people in San Francisco are more organized now after the whole kind of dot-com boom and bust? Or is it still kind of a atomized, kind of fractured community in terms of fighting for rent and, I mean, rent control and affordable housing?
I'd say we learned some important lessons about needing to see the struggle long term and needing to see we used to only talk about tenant rights, and then we started talking about gentrification, and then we started talking about land rights. And I think that for us was a shift in terms of our understanding of the situation, and that was brought about by the crisis, by us and our community experiencing the depth of the crisis. And there's certainly relationships between organizations that were formed in that period. But I wouldn't say we're more organized now than before. I think we need to get better organized, and I think one of the difficulties of the struggle against displacement, particularly in the dot-com period, was that we took on an electoral part of the struggle. And it was important because there were concrete gains that we would win, that we could win, that we knew we could win, that would affect people's daily lives. And then there's an aspect of demobilization that comes from it, and an aspect of investment in the regular way things are done. Well, that supervisor used to be an organizer. Mm-hmm. Well, why do we have to do anything? We can trust them because they're our friends. Rather than seeing the situation as, well, actually, this is a bigger scenario. And actually, people in City Hall have a little bit of power and not all the power. And if you're not organized, you're actually not going to win anyone. You're not going to win anything, no matter who's trying to run the show or write the laws. And I think that's another lesson for us to continue to reflect on in terms of that struggle, because there's a lot that we gained out of that. And then there's some lessons that we can learn about how we gained them and what to do in the future, because, you know, the struggle on a legal level or governmental level is important. And then if it's exclusive of a struggle on the popular level, like people's daily lives and the streets that we live in and the corporations that screw us, you know, it's very short term.
Mm-hmm. And in terms of just working with other groups through the Mission Anti Displacement Coalition, is that still sticking together, or is that kind of fractured?
With Mac?
Yeah, Mac.
Okay.
Or are there, I mean, your group working with other groups, is that improved?
Well, as of right now, we're still part of Mac. We're still part of the SRO Collaborative. We, you know, definitely coalition work is a way that, you know, we can work with other organizations and definitely try to get all the different strengths of different organizations together. In terms of Mac, right now, it's definitely going through a period where it's trying to build membership and trying to build build with the mission base once again. I think there was a time when I think Maria was saying, it was one lesson that we learned in terms of investing a lot of our energies in like more the legal battles. Like, we can spend, you know, 5 hours at a hearing, you know, waiting to hear about a certain project and everything. We may not even get to speak. You know, so there's definitely like lessons to learn from that of like, okay, are we on their terms or should we have them be on ours? Like, mm-hmm. I think it's a really big lesson, I think, that we've had to learn sometimes the hard way, you know, in terms of, you know, who, like,
sitting there for 5 hours at the hearing.
Exactly. It gives you time to think about things, you know, like, what is this all about anyway? You know, so it kind of like, it did help us really. So I think Mac has definitely been going through a period of more like reevaluating those tactics and seeing like, okay, what are some other things we can do? We can actually build people power instead of just trying to build like people to go to this hearing for this one specific time, mm-hmm. you know, which I think is a really good thing. It's something that we need right
Shift
now.
The power and, away from those formal processes and yeah. create new ones or?
Yeah. Well, certainly create the ability and the strength in our community to fight for the changes that we see that are necessary in our community, and not just the ability of a few people to navigate the complicated bureaucracy mm-hmm. that exists. And I think the People's Plan is basically Mac's direction, and it's a document that would that lays out the zoning and planning work that we want in our community. This is what we want built. This is what we don't want built. This is where we want a park. This is where we want an after-school center. This is where we want working-class jobs. We don't want this huge parking structure. We don't want this luxury housing. And it's very, it's sort of technical in terms of like, you know, we got architects and planners and people that can do things that I don't understand at all. But it's going to mean parks and housing and all that stuff, you know, getting. We also needed to use the tools that were available to us to actually have something to propose and not just always be saying, we don't like that. We don't like that either. We don't like that either. Mm-hmm. So the People's Plan is that for us. And right now we're in the stage of trying to get an environmental impact review on the People's Plan so that we can advocate for it more and the community can be involved in the struggle to defend it. One of the things that we are fighting for right now is that the environmental impact review consider the social impact and economic impact, not just the environmental impact that we consider human beings as part of the environment that people live in. And so then that we consider, well, what effect does it have when 50% of Latino families move out of one block? What effect does it have when after school centers shut down? Or when schools decrease their enrollment, things like that. And that's important to us because it would prove the importance of our plan. Because if people's needs are actually considered, then our plan makes more sense. Mm-hmm. Environmentally, in mm-hmm. terms of the non-human environment, it still makes more sense. But, you know, we want to make the best case we can make, and we want to change the terms of the debate with the planning department and not just be following their lead on everything. Oh, fill out this paper, go to this hearing. You know, we've been doing that for a little while.
Right. All right. Well, let's take a break, play a little music. This is DJ Sweetie on In the Meantime with Lupe and Maria. And we are going to come back and talk a little more, I think, about the People's Plan, maybe how that works, how you actually organize that, and then talk about your transition from a kind of a staff director organization into a collective. All right, this is Enemy Combatant Radio.